Okay, good afternoon.
I hope my voice won't give up.
Welcome to lecture 15, last week of a very long semester for many of you. The first semester, I hope you've had lots of fun at the university. I hope you've learned something. You can show it in April, I hope. Remember, there's going to be an exam, and I gave you some information about the exam last week. I'll give you a bit more information in a minute. It says admin, but before I do this, I'd like to hand out a handout. And this is just, you'll need this to follow the text that I'm going to play, or the audio that I'm going to play in a minute. I've made 100 copies, so I'll just give those two to you and then maybe you can just pass it on. One sheet each. I'll upload this as well to StudIP, so those of you who are not here need to check on StudIP for a handout which says extract channel crossing. Okay, while this is going around, let's talk about admin. Can I start? I know it's the last lecture, but still. Okay. Now, I've received quite a few assignments, a few more than just the BAs. I haven't marked them yet. I will do so in the next week, and I will upload the information again about the results. I will also make the solutions available to you. Okay. Now, those of you who want to prepare for the exam, or not just prepare for the exam, but who need further input, I have two things to offer, probably. One, definitely, that's what I usually do. I usually do a chat session on StudIP with anyone who wants to ask questions. Can I start? Okay, thank you. With anyone who wants to ask questions, this is usually a fairly chaotic chat session. We need to organize who does the talking or the typing at what time. In a way, we need to organize the kind of things that I'm going to talk about today, but that are not organized when we talk to each other face to face. When we have 25 people asking questions or 50 people asking questions and one person answering them, then some sort of order needs to be in place. And interestingly, when we speak, when we talk to each other, even if we're a group of people, there are very few problems about who talks when. But anyway, that's the topic for today. I will announce this on StudIP. I will write an email to you and we'll fix a date. And those of you who want to be in the chat room then can. And usually I also save the chat and make it available to everyone on StudIP as well. So even if you're not there, you can still see what we talked about. I think once in the past I've also offered a revision session in one of the lecture theatres, probably not in the big one, but it was somewhere else, where I just basically was around for 1.5 hours and people could ask questions about the content of the lectures. And I'll probably offer that again sometime towards the end of March. Okay. I'll also upload the solutions to the exercises, or at least, well, probably to all, yeah, but all the solution to the exercises, which I've always posted on StudIP, so that if you've done them and if you didn't do them in the tutorials, you should still be able to see whether what you did was what was expected. And something that I haven't done for the past few weeks, I'll also update the no lists. And they should be online next week, the latest. Okay. All right, that's all of the admin that I wanted to mention for today. Any other questions that are on your minds at the moment? Anything that isn't clear? remember, you need to sign up for the exam. Unless you sign up, we cannot let you into the room. So please make sure you don't forget. Okay. It should be open right now. Has anyone signed up already? Yes, okay, good. Okay, so it works. If you haven't, and if you're still considering whether to do it, listen to the beginning of last week's lecture, where I strongly recommended that you do it in April rather than at a later stage. Okay, let's go ahead with the lecture then. We're talking about conversation and discourse analysis, and I'd like to start with one of my favorite cartoons, Calvin and Hobbes again. You've seen a few throughout the semester. Here is a nice one for today's topic. When a person pauses in mid-sentence to choose a word, that's the best time to jump in and change the subject. It's like an interception in football. You grab the other guy's idea and run the opposite way with it. The more sentences you complete, the higher your score. The idea is to block the other guy's thoughts and express your own. That's how you win. Conversations are in contests. Okay, point for you, but I'm still ahead. Okay. Now, the question for today is basically whether that's how conversations work, whether they are contests or whether they are not, in what way they might be, and in particular, how who talks when is organized. Maybe you've done what I suggested you do, or at least I think I suggested you do. You've listened to what happens when you talk among a group of friends. You might be five or six people, and nevertheless, it's very, very rarely the case that several people are speaking at the same time. How does this work? How does this organize itself, or how do the speakers know when to speak? That's basically the question for today. Now, people have looked at spoken language and interaction for quite some time, for several decades. You will find both the terms conversation and discourse analysis. Conversation analysis and discourse analysis about this. This is a bit confusing because nowadays, as I'll say in a minute, they often mean pretty much the same thing, but because occasionally you'll see differences in literature that you might consult for a term paper that you're writing or something like that. I'd like to show you sort of the traditional difference. The traditional discourse analysis is basically an extension of what we did in syntax. Okay, in syntax, we looked at the structure of sentences, we looked at parts of sentences that fulfill certain functions, and that are sort of put together then in a larger text. And this put together in a larger text is basically what discourse analysis traditionally was concerned with. So basically it's a string of sentences, or perhaps a string of speech acts or utterances, rather than just a single sentence. But basically it's an extension of what we did in syntax. A lot of people who did this kind of analysis relied on their intuitions. They relied on what they think is happening in interaction, and they basically made up their own extracts of conversations and then were discussing what was going on there. So, in a way, to sum up, this is almost like a syntax of speech acts. And the question was, for a long time, whether utterances are well-formed or ill-formed, or coherent or incoherent. Now, this is very different in conversation analysis, which is an empirical approach, meaning that we look at real-life data, at authentic data that is observed, okay? And typically a lot of it. This is much more towards the approach that we typically take at this department, and I'll say something at the end of the lecture about this. We believe that intuition is unreliable, and working on the basis of constructed or invented examples doesn't really help. The aim of conversation analysis is to look at regularities and to find out how these regularities are systematic in the sense of typical of one or the other type of talking. Okay. Sequential organization of talk, I'll mention this later on again. What are the sequences of talk and how do they make sense as a whole? And this isn't really about being ill-formed or not. This is more about regularities and patterns. For example, does it really make sense when you see this? I have a 14-year-old son. Well, that's all right. I also have a dog. Oh, I'm sorry. Can you make sense of this? Not really, right? You need context. Is this ill-formed? Well, it looks odd. It meaning is odd, right? But think of it as in a situation where someone's looking for a flat and talking to the estate agent. They'd like to rent the flat, and kids are okay, but pets are not. And suddenly it falls into place and makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. So typically, conversation analysts think that we need to look at the larger context. It's not enough to just look at a sequence of made-up exchanges. We need to look at authentic language use. But as I said today, and that's partly because it has been much more common in the recent past to look at real-life data, today you might find both conversation analysis and discourse analysis referring to the exact same thing. So I may actually use them interchangeably as well. Okay, that was a bit of background on terminology, which sometimes is necessary because, as you may have noticed in linguistics, we often have different names for the same thing. One of the most common responses to a linguistic question is often, it depends, and then it depends on how you define it, how you name it, etc. I know this is annoying. Students typically like clear-cut definitions, but very often that's simply not the case. Okay, today we're mostly talking about spontaneous conversation, the kind of face-to-face conversation that happens among friends, family, etc., etc. And I'd like to ask some questions to start with before I play the extract that you've got on your handout. I've already noticed or mentioned that we don't seem to have a script when we talk to each other. It's not as if this is we're all part of a play, a piece of drama that's been set up, and we know exactly when to say what. Okay. Now, of course, in the situation that we're currently in, this is a bit like a sort of a pre-configured situation. I'm supposed to be doing the talking, and you're supposed to be doing the listening. But this is not the kind of situation that we're mostly concerned with today. We're talking about spontaneous interaction. So how do we know if there is no script, when to stop? How is it possible that one person often starts immediately after the other one has stopped? Clearly, this isn't just anything goes, or an anything goes situation. It's not that everyone can talk at the same time, because then that wouldn't work. Now, as I said, some situations, and we're in one of those, are more regulated than others. I've given you the classroom or the lecture situation, certain institutional settings where it's clear who opens a meeting, who gets to talk, when. In certain cultural settings, for example, in participants in a meeting in a place or in a country like Burundi, apparently it's very clear who talks when according to social status, rank, and age. Okay. But, well, I'll play you an extract now, and this isn't about who talks when according to age or to a preconceived order of events. This is just simply a dinner conversation. And as you'll see, there is quite a lot of, well, there's quite a lot going on in the sense that people talk to each other, with each other, sometimes at the same time. But listen to it and think about whether it is chaos or whether this is ordered. It's an extract that's called Channel Crossing. It's a fairly old recording from the 70s, if I remember correctly. And it's two couples talking to each other about their holidays, and it's about crossing the channel with one of the ferries and what can go wrong, etc., etc. Just, I'll play it again towards the end of the lecture, and I'll then use this to invite you to think about a number of the features that I'm going to talk about. But at the moment, just listen to it, follow it, and think about or notice who talks when and what causes language speaker change, and whether this sounds chaotic or not.
And so, channel crossing.
So we were travelling out of London with a nightclub, and we had a super cab in, which was just below the nightclub. Actually, Sandra, you know, when you think what ours is like, when we shut our cabin door, you wouldn't know there was anything outside, and it was a nightclub, pounding music away, just one, so immediately overhead, and we were the cabin next to it, and you couldn't hear it at all. And of course, you could say to the children, we'd just be upstairs, and they knew they'd just have to put their dressing gown on and come up down to it, so that was super.
Speaker change, there is sometimes overlap. And in at least one case, I think the woman really sort of grabs the floor, right? But certainly, we, etc., etc. But very often, what also happens is that someone says something, and then there is a tiny bit of a pause, maybe just to breathe in, and then one or two people just at that very moment say, listen to that again towards the end of the lecture. Why do they know that exactly then, at the very same moment, they have to? Well, they don't have to, but they feel like saying, giving a so-called back channel, etc., etc. This is interesting, I think. How does it work? Let's make some very trivial observations. I will be saying a few relatively trivial things today, but sometimes just making sense of what's trivially the case allows you to look deeper and look at the mechanisms of language that underlie what's going on. Now, a very trivial observation is that there is speaker change. And not just once, but it recurs. Everyone gets something to say at some stage. Usually only one person speaks at the time. There was overlap, but it is, if you look at it from the point of view of percentage, it's a fairly small percentage. There are long stretches where only one person speaks. Turn size is variable. Yes. Okay. It's not that everyone gets 12 and a half seconds and needs to say everything in that, and then it's the next person's turn. Some of the turns, when, for example, when one of the women talks, are fairly long. Others are just maybe 1 or 2 seconds. And that's clearly because the length of what's going on of the conversation is not specified in advance. They haven't fixed anything, really. They're just talking. Also, the content isn't fixed. They're making things up. Well, they're making things up in the sense of they choose what they want to talk about, the topics, etc., just while doing it. Okay, it's possible for this to develop. Of course, we know all of this. Yeah? This is, as I said, trivial. But how does this work? And that's what people started being interested in, in the early 70s of the last century, of the last millennium, 1970s. And the most influential paper that was published, or that started off quite a bit of research, is the one by Sachs and colleagues, A Simplest Systematics for the Organization of Turn-Taking for Conversation. And it was published in the journal Language, which is the most prestigious journal in linguistics. Someone once told me, if you've published in Language, then you've made it. I haven't published in Language yet, so it's really difficult to get in. Okay, and what they said can be summarized as turn-taking rules. And again, this is fairly trivial, but they suggested that what's happening can be set up as almost like a circular set of rules. The first option is that the current speaker can select, that is, choose who will be the next speaker. If that doesn't happen, another person can self-select. Yes? And if neither of the two options happen, then the current speaker can just basically continue speaking. If that doesn't happen, then there will be a pause. People don't like pauses, long silences. Try to sit with someone you don't know very well in a car and don't say anything. They will be feeling very uncomfortable. That's because we assume that speaker change must happen. Now, these are three rules, and they continue again and again to be applied at various places in the discourse. And these places in the discourse are so-called transition relevance places. And we've got a nice abbreviation for this, a TRP. In the last lecture, we had an FTA, a face-threatening act. This one is a TRP, a transition relevance place, which basically means that there is something, what it exactly looks like is difficult to say, but there is something at various intervals in the conversation which allows either 1A or 1B or 1C to take place. Just to give you an example, for 1A, can you tell me the time? John, this is a slight variation of a sentence that I used in the pragmatics lecture. Well, the milkman has come. Here, A selects the next speaker, and the next speaker actually starts talking. This would be an example for 1A. If that doesn't happen, then, well, if there is no other selection, then of course you can also self-select as a conversational partner. I bought a new car yesterday. Oh, did you? What color is it? There is no, oh, I bought a new car yesterday. John, now you can say something. Okay, obviously. Yeah. Oh, did you? What color is it? And if that doesn't happen, then we've got 1-3. 1C, sorry. I bought a new car yesterday. Silence. And then A may feel compelled to go on and say, well, the old one was about to die, you know. These are constructed examples, of course, but they exemplify what's going on typically quite well. Now, the main question in this context is, how do we determine what a transition relevance place is? And we seem to be able to do this quite well. If you listen to the extract, these speakers seem to be able to know when to start speaking. Now, one contributing factor is clearly meaning. If what one speaker said is complete, then that is an option for the second person to start talking. Again, that's trivial, but as I said, sometimes you need to say the trivial. There may also be formal features. Of course, when we speak, we can help our conversational partners quite a lot by using different types of intonation. There might be different intonation contours, and they indicate whether I am finished with my turn or not. I may also lengthen certain syllables at the end of a term to indicate that I'm quite willing to give away the right to the floor. Of course, there might also be non-linguistic signals related to gaze, looking at people, or just basically even using my hands or something like that, body posture. Right, and another extremely basic and fundamental fact of conversation seems to be that we expect it to be ordered. We expect it to be ordered in pairs. For example, how old are you? Well, what's that? It's a question. And the response might be 21. That's a question-answer pair. It's a so-called adjacency pair because, well, they're adjacent because they're next to each other. They almost sort of like touch each other. Okay. And the first one calls for the second one to happen. We might have question-answer adjacency pairs. We might have greetings, announcement, receipt, etc., etc. And we, as speakers, seem to have knowledge about them sort of ingrained in our experience of what's going on in spoken language. It's natural to answer, to respond to a question. These are sometimes referred to as typed pairs. And because they are so regular and so expected, they seem to have an impact on, well, they seem to almost put an order into what could be chaos. Theoretically. Now, adjacency pairs, the name suggests that they're adjacent, obviously, but sometimes something else happens. Can I have a bottle of scotch, please? And if this is a conversation in a shop in the States, then you might not get a response or a bottle, but basically another question. Are you 21? No. No is the response to the second question. And then, on the basis of the information that was required, the response to the first line on the slide follows. Is this still an adjacency pair? Well, in a way, yes. But it's just that between the two elements that are the adjacency pair, there is an insertion sequence. Something is placed in between. And often, the fact that something is missing in the insertion, in the adjacency pair, will be useful for the interpretation of what's going on. I'll give you an example. This is rather theoretical, but I'll give you an example to help you understand this. Do you want to test the potatoes? This is husband and wife, I guess. This is a really interesting article about racism in the police force. They're saying there's got to be a massive education campaign to change the way people think. Does that make sense? Not really. Think about pragmatics. Think about the cooperative principle, the maxims, maxim of relevance. This is a question. Is there a response to that question? Well, it doesn't look like one. On the basis of the assumption that we expect one, the wife probably can make sense of the meaning of what's going on here. Probably, no, I don't really want to, or something like that. She responds to with, yes, there certainly has. Yeah. And then she tries again. Potatoes, fork. Okay. Basically, this, he gives up. Okay, he then helps her, right? But basically, the making sense of the second utterance is helped by the fact that, of course, we expect a response. We know that response is not relevant, and therefore we can make sense of it on the basis of the cooperative principle. So basically, discourse analysis or conversation analysis and pragmatics hang together. Sometimes this can actually get quite complex. Here is a brief exchange that happens in a shop. Or actually, it might even be over the phone. I think it's probably over the phone, if I remember correctly. Yes, it's over the phone, sorry. B wants to order something from A and says, I ordered some paint from you a couple of weeks ago, some vermilion, and I just wanted to order more. The name's Boyd. Yes, how many tubes would you like, sir? What's the price now with VAT, do you know? I'll just work that out for you. Thanks. And there's a 10 seconds break, sorry, not 10 minutes. £3.19 a tube, sir. £3.19, is it? Yeah. That's just a thing. That was £3.19. That's for the large tube, is it? Well, isn't it, actually? Well, yeah, it's the 37 CCS. I'll tell you what, I'll just ring you back. I have to work out how many I'll need. Sorry, wasn't sure of the price, you see. Okay. This sounds like a fairly natural conversation, even though when I'm reading it, it probably sounds much less natural, but you can see how this could actually happen on the phone. And this also is organized according to adjacency pairs. But it's a little bit more complex, and I'd like to show you how. We start with a request. I wanted to order some more. The name's Boyd. That is responded to by a question, which you could sort of say is not the normal way to respond to a request, but really, well, it makes sense here because we need to know how many are being asked, should be ordered. Okay. Now, when does the response to question one happen? Well, certainly not immediately, because it's followed by another question. What's the price now? And in fact, that isn't responded to. And I accept as a listener that it isn't immediately responded to, because I need to work this out as a shop assistant. And then we get the answer to the second question, which now completes one adjacency pair in the text. That is then followed by a third question, which is immediately answered. This is followed by a fourth question, which is again immediately responded to. So again, we have a direct adjacency pair. And then what do we get? Well, the adjacency pair which was opened at the beginning of the exchange, question one, hasn't been responded to. And that's still sort of in the air. It still guides what's going on between those two speakers. Is the response given to complete the adjacency pair? Well, no, not really. But rather, what follows is an account for why no response or no answer can be given. I need to work it out. I didn't know at the price, and therefore I will not tell you how many I'm going to order. And it's as if the first question up here has left something hanging in the air or in the conversation that needed to be fulfilled or needed to be supplied before the conversation can be finished. Again, this is trivial in a way, but it shows how organization, how conversations are organized in adjacency pairs that raise expectations about what follows next. There are a couple of questions here in this extract, and there are preferred and dispreferred ways of answering these kind of requests or questions. And the forms that we use when answering them tend to differ. If the child, admittedly this is a fairly unusual question of a child, but sometimes that might happen, could you put out the room light for my room? And the father then says, sure. That is what the child wanted, and the father therefore provides a preferred response. Anything special here? No. Have a look at this. I wonder whether there is any chance of seeing you tomorrow, sometime morning or before the seminar. 1 second pause. I doubt it. The reason is I'm seeing Elizabeth. Is that a preferred response? No, obviously not. C wants to see R, but R actually has something else to do. But what happens? It's not no, but there is some face work going on. There is a way to lower the impact of the negative response. How does this work? Well, for example, we've got pauses. Okay, something like that. A filled pause, or in fact, a pause before the person responds. Whose pause is this, by the way? Is this the pause of the speaker C, or is it the pause of the speaker R? Probably makes more sense to assign it to speaker R, because that pause actually is indicative, to a certain extent, of the fact that the response is going to be dispreferred. Again, this is something that you, I'm sure, can listen to when you talk to, when you ask people to do something for you. If you get an immediate confirmation, a preferred response, then that will typically happen much more quickly. On the other hand, if you're asking someone to do something and they can't or don't want to do it, then typically this is accompanied by all sorts of other measures, pauses, filled pauses, and maybe also softeners, hesitation markers, etc., etc. So, delays, pauses, prefaces in the sense of, well, that sounds nice, but unfortunately I'll have to work tonight or study for an exam or something like that. And this explanation that I give is also often part of that kind of dispreferred response. And it's only after that that people typically say no. I'll give you another example. Do you want to come out to the pub tonight? 2 seconds pause. Well, thanks, but I have to wash my hair tonight, so no, I can't make it tonight. Again, I'm quite sure this is a constructed example, but you can see what's going on. And here, I've put the break, not the break, I've put the pause to speaker B, and that's because that pause is meaningful. And if you think back to week one, you may recognize these examples. God, isn't this picture awful? Right? I show that to you. And of course, silence in this case means disagreement. This is an adjacency pair, but the lack of the second part makes sense. I'm getting fat. Silence. Agreement. So it's our knowledge of what typically happens in sequences or in sequence in conversation that helps us make sense of silence. Okay, so we had the very basic turn-taking rules, we had adjacency pairs, and we had preferred and dispreferred responses. These are three concepts that are important. Another concept that I'd like to introduce is repairs. Repairs in the sense of repairing something that went wrong in the conversation. Something is said that isn't right. For example, she was giving me all the people that were gone this year. I mean this quarter, you know? Yeah. She was giving me all the people that were gone this year. Oh no, it wasn't this year. And I, as a speaker, self-repair. And in fact, it's not only self-repair, but it's self-initiated self-repair. B didn't say, huh? Or something like that. What do you mean, this year? And then, if the speaker had said, oh, no, 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 quarter, then that would still be a self-repair, but it would be an other-initiated self-repair. Now, the self-initiated self-repair is the most preferred option for speakers. It's the one... No, I won't say that sentence yet. Let's see on the next slide. But, you know, single beds are awfully thin to sleep on. What? Single beds, they're... You mean narrow? They're awfully narrow, yeah. Okay. Now, this is, of course, the opposite. Someone is making the conversational partner aware of the fact that they've said something that doesn't make sense. And not only does that happen, they also basically correct the speaker in giving what they consider to be the better way of phrasing it. This is an other-initiated other repair, and that's the least preferred option. Why is that the least preferred option, and why is the other one the most preferred option? Well, think face, think politeness, think face-saving strategies. The other-initiated other repair is much more of a face attack than if you self-correct without being prompted, even though that is also perhaps a slight attack to your own face. But it's very different from being corrected by a conversational partner. Notice also what we see here. There is overlap. This is indicated with these two slashes. So there and you mean narrow are spoken at the same time. This is an interruption, one could say. A wanted to go on speaking, but is interrupted by B. Now, one reason why all of this is important and why it is interesting to look at what's going on in conversation is because language is very important for who we are, for our identity, and the concept of face, of course, is just one facet of this. But it's, as it says here, one of the fundamental ways in which human beings define themselves as part of a group or society. Now, as a result of this, of course, the way we converse depends on our status, for example, or how well we know each other, the kind of relationships we have with the participants in the interaction. And we briefly touched on this in the lecture on politeness. This is one of the many ways of variation, and you will be talking more about variation in the next semester variation is one of the main areas of interest. I also briefly touched on cross-cultural communication the last time. I did this in the context of politeness and of having different face-saving strategies. But of course this can also be felt when we look at something like pause length. If you've ever spent some time with a Finnish or Norwegian speaker, you might have noticed that their acceptance or their willingness to accept long pauses in conversation is much greater than yours, unless you're Finnish or Norwegian. And this can lead to misunderstandings. You might feel that the other person ignores you or is uncooperative, or you try to make sense of pauses because you know you've just given the first part of an adjacency pair, but nothing is following. Well, something would be following, but just at a different pace, by which time you may have already gone on saying something, and the Norwegian speaker thinks, what an impolite German speaker, just constantly interrupts me. Okay. Now, something like this is also at the heart of, some people claim, much of what's going on between men and women when they come, when they have conversations. Okay. Because basically, the claim is that these are different conversational styles, and these differences may lead to misunderstandings. Okay. Now, if you want to have a really good read that is linguistic but not technical, then You Just Don't Understand by Deborah Tannen is a good start. Deborah Tannen is a serious linguist. She's also done some much more linguistic studies. But this is a book that's written for lay audiences, and some of you may have read it, in fact. And I'll say a few things about what she says about how men and women are communicating with each other. Much of what I'm going to say is very black and white. Okay, so don't take this at face value. Things are probably much more complicated than that. But the basic claim is we're talking about cross-cultural communication. Men and women belong to different cultures, and she's termed, or some people say, talk about genderlects. And the point is that this may actually have to do with the organization of conversation, who talks when, or who interrupts who, at which time in the conversation. She says it really goes back to how we are socialized. Often these, girls and boys will grow up in same-sex groups. I'm not sure this is actually so much the case in Germany, but they play different games. They use, in that sense, a different language. You know? She talks about different worlds of words. This is really black and white now, but I'm just to make the point. Boys are more likely to play outside in larger groups, and there is always a leader present. While in girls are observed to be playing in small groups or in pairs. People have looked at the linguistic use of commands in boys-only groups and have found that these commands are often given without giving further reasons. Many more direct insults. This is about status and power. As I said, black and white, but girls are supposed to be much more cooperative. There's much more let's, okay, supporting a common cause, etc. The power of community rather than the power of an individual speaker. So really this boils down to two things, contest versus community. While on the one hand there might be aggression, there's lots of. This is something very, very funny is happening there, right? Can you either stop or talk about it outside? No matter whether you're male or female, I don't mind. But okay. Right. Otherwise, there might be an aggression and fight from my part, right? Because I'm being boyish and, Anyway, but in fact what she claims is that this kind of verbal aggression might in fact be necessary to facilitate friendships among boys, between boys. So in that sense, disagreement, which is uttered in an aggressive way, might actually be yeah, she's going a bit too far there, I think. But still, a sign of intimacy. Okay. While the good girls seem to look for agreement in being peacemakers. So, disagreement is something different. Disagreement is a threat to intimacy, while disagreement for men is supposed to be not a threat, but actually a way to intimacy. So basically, women, when they communicate, a threat to their... Well, what is a threat? A conflict in the community. And for men, it's supposed to be loss of independence. How often do men ask for directions in cars when they're driving? Not really, right? Why? Because it's loss of independence, some people say. And then they get into trouble with their wives because they didn't ask. So both men and women avoid the threats that they perceive as threats, and that then results in misunderstandings. We can see how this happens. Okay. Deborah Tannen speaks of experience. I think she's divorced, so that's... But I think she has a point to a certain extent. So she says, if men see life in terms of contest, a struggle against nature and other men, for women life is a struggle against the danger of being cut off from their community. And basically she brings in the terms of rapport talk versus rapport talk. The main problem in male-female conversation is the lack of flexibility. Both want something... Well, basically the same thing, namely to be nice to the conversational partner, but because they are sort of speaking in different worlds, it results in misunderstandings. So the more a clash of understanding becomes evident, the more both parties insist on their styles, which makes things only worse. And the point is that all of this works unconsciously, and we simply aren't aware of these differences. And maybe if people were aware of these conversational styles and the differences between them, we could make sense of much more that's going on, that's killing marriages and things like that. Okay. I'm not saying that everything boils down to language, but clearly there is something to this. For example, in the context of interruptions, I mean, there are these clichés about, and they're partly completely wrong, yeah? But there are these clichés about the fact that women are supposed to interrupt more, right? Well, maybe it's just that interruptions, however they are defined, carry different... No. Maybe it's just that whatever counts as an interruption for a man is not an interruption for a woman. Interruption is particularly painful in close relationships, where this carries a lot more than just, well, it's just something that happens by chance. Yeah? You always interrupt me. But maybe we're not actually talking about an interruption when a woman says something acoustically at the same time as a man, but maybe it's much more a supportive saying something at the same time. We'll listen to this again towards the end of the lecture, where the woman can be seen to say something at the same time as her husband, and very often, if you look at the content, this is actually not challenging the husband, but is basically supporting them. So we really need to define what is an interruption before we look at gender differences, because we might look at interruption as strictly from the acoustic point of view, when two people talk at the same time. But that will be giving us lots of situations as interruptions which are in fact not felt as interruptions, or at least not by the person, or not intended as an interruption. It might be much more useful to come up with a functional definition, although this is more difficult, What's the effect on the conversation? There can be interruption without overlap, depending on whether there was a transition relevance place or not, or whether the adjacency pair that was opened by one speaker is fulfilled. If not, then that might count as an interruption for the listener, even though there is absolutely no overlap. So interruption has to do potentially with competition, a contest, and that's why at the beginning I showed you the Calvin and Hobbes cartoon. Yes, this might have to do, at least from the male perspective, with issues of dominance, but people have observed that particularly women tend to be cooperative overlappers, in the sense that it's just interpreted differently in their world, while the men constantly see it as an interruption when it wasn't intended to be. So that's why it does actually make sense to look at conversations and the mechanisms in more detail, because it might actually have an impact on how we interpret completely different or non-linguistic aspects like personal relationships. Marriages can be saved with linguistics, right? In a way. Well, not really, but at least we can explain what's going on. Now, of course, and as I said, this was very black and white, but there is something behind this, and I think it's not only male-female conversations where these kind of things happen. Deborah Tannen has done research on dinner conversations that involved Californians and New Yorkers, and in more particularly Jewish New Yorkers, who are said to have a particular way of speaking. One of our language teachers, Anna Maria Duplan, she grew up in New York in a community where there were a lot of Jewish speakers of English. And she has a slightly different style from other Americans, from Californians, etc., and that is interpreted to be, sometimes negatively interpreted, to be more interruptive or pushy or something like that. But it's actually just because she socialized, or she got socialized, in this context of Jewish New Yorkers. And Deborah Tannen has done a nice study on what goes wrong in this dinner conversation where there is a group of friends who are all Jewish New Yorkers, and there is there's a man from California who is much more relaxed and cool, who feels that he's being attacked by these Jewish New Yorkers. And we have a brief extract here, which I'm not going to read as a whole, but basically what happens is that there is an interruption. Well, maybe I'll show you, this is better on the next slide. You live in LA? Yeah. Visiting here? Yeah. What do you do there? I work at Disney, Walt Disney. You're an artist? No. Writer? Yeah, I write, etc. So there are sort of questions that basically are, well, they call it the machine gun question. Okay. Now, this is not aggressive at all. Chad feels assaulted. Well, you would be if a machine gun was pointed at you. But it wasn't intended to be at all. It's just a different conversational style. And Tannen's claim is basically, just in the same way as women and men have different genderlects, there might be different, or there are different conversational styles when you look at Californians and Jewish New Yorkers. And we are not, as speakers who speak the same language, English, aware of these differences, and that may lead to problems. Okay, that was a bit on interruptions and conversational styles, and quite a bit on men versus women. And I'd like to introduce a few more markers. Yes, here I'm doing it again. What have I done? This was a hesitation marker. And this one, again, I didn't do on purpose. Has hesitation, right? I said. This is some sort of repetition. I did this because what I'm producing now, I'm producing online, so to speak. This is nothing... Well, I've thought about what I want to say, and I have help in the form of slides, but basically I'm making up my sentences while I'm speaking. I'm not reading off a script. And that will have an impact on things that I produce. And of course, that's why repetition and filled pauses are very frequent in spoken interaction. Well, I've in a way already given you a reason, because I'm using my brains at the moment, of course, but... Okay, here is another one. This is really difficult usually. When I talk about hesitation markers, I tend to produce lots of hesitation markers. I try not to. Sometimes, of course, it might be hesitation proper. I'm simply hesitating to give the answer because I feel that I might offend you with it. Am I looking fat? No. Okay. No, actually no. Yeah? Something like that. I might simply hesitate to give an honest response. But there are other reasons why hesitation markers can happen. What shall we talk about? Well, I wanted to talk about the hostages. Yes. And some people have claimed that this filled pause is actually a transition relevance place. It not indicating a hesitation that relates to the fact that the speaker doesn't find their words, but in fact, that it's a signpost of, okay, it's your turn to talk if you want to. Sometimes we might also use filled pauses to highlight individual words. For 6 hours after the aromatherapy. Now this might be because it's a long word that I need to retrieve from memory, but it might also be to put special focus on the word. And there are a few other uses of filled pauses. And the final use is basically what I started with, the fact that I'm talking to you without a script, that I'm not reading off. I am producing these hesitation markers because my brain, in a way, isn't fast enough to create what I need to create. And sometimes that results in the production of filled pauses. They typically occur at syntactic boundaries, which shows that we seem to put things together according to the hierarchies of syntax that we talked about for 4 lectures earlier on in the semester. Some people also ask whether things like are actually words, because they can carry meaning in that pragmatic meaning. But most people say they're just empty disfluency markers. Okay, getting towards the end of what I wanted to say about conversation, but before we do this, before we wrap up, and I'll say a few things about a completely different topic, I would like to ask how much of what I've said, so things like adjacency pairs, pauses, interruptions, and the workings of conversation, how much of this actually relies on non-linguistic criteria? For example, the selection of another speaker might, of course, not only happen by saying, "How old are you, John?" but I might also indicate with my gaze or body posture or whatever that it's the other speaker's turn. Now, because this is the case, it is interesting to see what happens when there is no way to look at the conversational partner. Do the same kind of mechanisms apply? And of course, that happens in phone conversations. We can't rely on turn-taking cues that are visual in phone conversations unless we're using Skype or video phone or something like that. And it's interesting to look at various stages of such a conversation. Openings, who chooses the topic, who and how is the topic changed, and how are conversations closed, again, without seeing each other. Now, what typically happened before we know who's calling simply because the caller ID is shown, that the first interaction is basically meant to identify yourself. But what's actually going on here is that C causes the phone to ring, okay, at someone's place, and then the person picks up the phone and says, hello, hi, oh hi. Now is that an adjacency pair? Well, in a way it's two adjacency pairs, and the first hello is the second part of an adjacency pair, which was, or the first part was, a summons. So, yeah. First topic slot. Who starts the first topic? Hello, hello Rob, this is Laurie. How's everything? Pretty good. How about you? Just fine. The reason I called. Okay. This is almost institutionalized, well, or at least conventionalized. Who starts the same, starts the topic, the first topic in a conversation? And if something different happens, if the person who is being called starts the first topic, then that would have to be linguistically marked, would require extra face work, etc., etc. How do we change topics when we don't see each other? Well, it seems to be related to linguistic markers like, well, as you can see here, it's okay, we'll pop down tomorrow, Gertrude. And then the other speaker says, you sure you don't? It's an awful lot of it. You quickly want to nip down now for it? Okay, I will. Hey, you, that is, have you been lighting a fire down there? Okay, this is again a constructed dialogue, I guess. But the point is that speakers seem to prepare conversational partners, particularly over the phone, to the beginning of a new topic by various features or by using various features like increased amplitude, raised pitch, etc., etc., and these markers of discontinuity, hey. So this seems to help speakers to know what's going on in the sense of, oh, there is a new topic coming. Perhaps the most interesting, or at least the one that I find most interesting, issue of phone conversations is how to stop it. That's a rather potentially face-threatening exercise. How do you make sure that you're not stopping the other person from saying something that they still wanted to say, and how do you not sort of go on for too long that it becomes embarrassing? Now, what I'm going to read to you now will sound terribly unnatural, but in fact, if you were to listen to this, then this would sound perfectly okay. Why don't we all have lunch? Okay, so that would be in St. Jude's, would it? Yes. Okay, so 1 o'clock in the bar. Okay, okay, okay then. Thanks very much indeed, George. All right, see you there. See you there. Okay, okay, bye, bye. Okay, there's lots of adjacency pairs again, but basically, both speakers need to make sure that it's okay to finish the conversation. In this context, I usually like to talk about my former boss, my PhD supervisor, who still today, and I've known her for, I don't know, 15 years or more, who still today sometimes strikes me as being odd, or, well, not odd, but potentially unfriendly, which she isn't at all, because sometimes she finishes her phone conversations with me or her Skype conversations with me very, very quickly. At some stage, I feel, she just says, okay, bye, and then I said, wait a minute. What did I, at the beginning I thought I was being impolite and she just wanted to stop, but it's just probably, again, also cross-cultural, or well, she's Swedish, American, or something else, I don't know. Or it's just an idiolect in the sense that this is how she finishes conversations. But it's something that caused me some worries at the beginning because I misinterpreted the way she finished our conversations. So this has an impact on the way people interact. Yeah. And there are these cultural differences. The other example that I usually mention in this context, that in Switzerland, and perhaps also to a certain extent in Germany, but I think more so in Switzerland, it is extremely important that you thank the person for calling. Yeah? Thank you for calling. Even if there is actually no need to thank or no reason to thank the other person for calling. And once or twice I actually tried to not say thank you for calling at the time when I would have been expected to, and then the other person on the phone said thank you too, even though I didn't say thank you. So it's so conventionalized in certain settings that even if the first part of the adjacency pair isn't offered, the second one happens. Okay. So I'd like to revisit the dinner conversation now. And I'd like you to listen to it again. I'd like you to listen to the aspects that I talked about, obviously the general term-taking, but also things like overlap, interruptions, repair. There are a couple of repairs in there. Pauses, hesitation markers. I didn't talk about things like back channels, these little words or sounds people make to show the conversational partner that they can go on with their turn. Listen to where they happen. I'll just play it again and then I'll finish with a few words on something completely different.
And so, channel crossing.
But in fact, the other one was the nightclub, and we had a super cabin which was just below the nightclub. Actually, Sandra, do you know anything what ours is like? Mm-hmm. When we shut our cabin door, even though there was anything outside, it was a nightclub, pando music room, just one immediately overhead, and we were a cabin next to it. And we couldn't hear it at all. Mm-hmm. And of course, we could say to the children, we'd just be upstairs, and they knew they'd just have to put their dressing gown on and come up and down to it. So that was super.
Wait, did you have a car with you?
There's one or two in the past.
How did you get? I mean, how did you find that out? Because,
what?
You know, some people say that the drag car across a ferry is the devil of a job.
Well,
I mean, taking a car across to the continent
on
a ferry is hell.
No, it isn't at all.
This crossing, you automatically have a cabin. But on the cross channel, once you don't. But if it's a day one, you can have a day cabin, you can pay for a couple of pounds. And it's probably worth it for the kids. And you just
have
to be like,
well, I'll tell you something, every summer, you see stories of tremendous queues.
Living on the books.
Yeah. And people.
Mind you, last summer there was a weekend where the queues were so bad, even people were booked
from the
school.
And it was something to
do with
the strike,
wasn't it? Yeah, there was something.
But certainly, in the past, we've just grown up. If we go to Southampton, then I'll go to Sheffield, then we book. And I don't want to know what would happen. If, for example, there are often people who broke down, for example, so they missed their booking, or the child has been ill, so they stopped somewhere and they missed their booking, and those people have to wait for a vacancy. In the years we've been there, they've got on usually. There haven't been masses of people waiting to get on. But when the year that we did break down, we were actually put back across from the Rhine or Calais or somewhere, and we just drove out and got onto the boat.
That was very busy weekend, and they put on lots of extra boats, and we were all late on Sunday, and we just drove straight on.
Yeah.
We were very happy.
Okay. Quite a few repairs, some other initiated other repairs, some. And other initiate self repairs, some cooperative overlapping, etc., etc. Quite a lot of the aspects that we talked about can be very nicely found in this extract. And in fact, not just in this extract, in virtually all conversation that's going on. I could have chosen almost any other conversation between friends over dinner or on the bus or something like that. And I could probably show most of these aspects to you with that kind of recording as well. The kind of concepts that I would like you to take home are, well, the basic term-taking rules, the simplest systematics that Sachs et al. Have talked about, The adjacency pair is a basic way of ordering conversation that raises expectations and therefore then guides conversational partners to provide the second part of the pair, or if it can't be produced, it will be clear to the conversational partner why it can't be used. People will make sense of this. We briefly talked about the communicative impact of pauses. I mentioned preferred and preferred responses. I spent some time to talk about men and women. And that led to a discussion of interruptions and the fact that what may be interpreted as an interruption by a man who has a more competitive way of looking at conversation might actually be meant as a cooperative overlap on the part of the woman, or from the perspective of the woman. And we ended by looking at phone conversations to make the point that quite a lot of what I talked about is not dependent on visual impact or visual aspects, but seems to be working even without this kind of visual input. Okay, the last few minutes, I would like to talk about the thing that I didn't talk about this semester. Okay. Because typically, there are 15 lectures. We only did 14 because one lecture had to be cancelled because of a holiday. Now, in the last lecture, I typically talk about corpus linguistics, which is a method of doing linguistics, and it's a method that we use a lot at the department here in Trier. Okay. Now, for those of you who want, this is absolutely non-compulsory, for those of you who want to listen to this lecture, they can. I will make it available on the streaming server. I will just basically put the lecture that I recorded 2 years ago online. So please disregard any admin that talks about things that are not of relevance to you at the beginning of this. But then if you want to listen to that lecture, after a few minutes, the relevant stuff will start. Corpus linguistics, just to give you a very brief introduction, is a method to look at language, and in fact, at lots of language, millions and millions or hundreds of millions of words of authentic language, and we say that intuition is hopeless, or not hopeless, but at least not as helpful as looking at large amounts of text that were produced by a cross-section of the speakers of a community, and by looking at the patterns that emerge from this text or from this corpus, we can draw conclusions about language that you could not draw when using intuition alone. Okay. So I recommend that you look at this or that you listen to the lecture, because it's something that, depending on who you take courses with, you're quite likely to be exposed to again later on in your career. But just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, I'd like to run one or two queries on a corpus, on one corpus that I'm particularly familiar with, which is the British National Corpus, which contains 100 million words of spoken and written British English. Can you tell me what can be caused? I cause X, or he causes X. What is X most likely to be?
Trouble?
Trouble, okay. Anything else? Noise? No. Happiness? Can you cause happiness? Can you cause bliss? Some people know. What else can you cause? Why don't you know? Well, you don't know because, well, you can say you're not native speakers of English, but if I ask you the same question about German, well, you'd have some ideas of what can be caused, but come on, give me a few more words. He causes trouble.
An accident.
An accident, okay. What else? illness. You're all very negative people, right? Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'd like to have a quick look. And who feels that you can cause bliss? Or who has anyone ever caused bliss or happiness before? If you ask native speakers, then they say, yeah, why not? Why not? Okay. Well, I'd like to have a quick look. And I need to use a different setting in order to be able to do this. Okay. Now, this is an interface to the British National Corpus. Yes, it down says there are new feature access to audio recordings. This is a recent development where you can now not only read the transcripts, but you can hear them as well. There is 90 million words of written language and 10 million words of spoken language. This is a lot of data. Well, let's have a look at cause. And in fact, I'm going to use a special syntax which allows me to not just look for cause, but also cause, causing, causes, and caused. So, dilemma, rather than just an individual word form. Okay. And in fact, I'm going to restrict it to verbs. Okay. So, what can be caused? We have 20,000 hits, a lot of instances. I'll put them in random order. So, caused by an unwieldy bureaucracy. Well, this is a different construction. This is a passive, right? Causing an explosion. Causing severe fluctuations. It can cause death. Yeah, that's negative. Severe fluctuations. Usually, at least, yes. Causing other tensions. Yeah. Did you think of tensions and death before? Now, how likely are tension and death after cause? Well, there is a tool that allows you to calculate collocations. Collocations are words that often co-occur, that seem to belong together, so to speak. And this tool now looks at those 20,000 instances and builds up a database in the background that allows you to statistically evaluate what are the most likely co-occurrences. Okay? And as you can see, by is the most frequent, not the most frequent, but the most likely word to happen after cause. And we can see damage and problems here. Okay. Now, I'm going to restrict this to the three words that follow cause. And I'm going to say, I only want nouns. And now let's see what kind of list we're being shown. Damage, problems, harm, trouble, concern, death, injury, confusion, distress, difficulties, disruption, havoc, stir, pain, chaos, loss, etc., etc. Controversy, embarrassment, deaths, cancer, alarm, delay, suffering. That's pretty negative, isn't it? If you show this list to native speakers, many of them will say, yeah, okay, yeah. Some will actually say, oh, that's surprising, I wouldn't have thought that. And that basically goes to show that native speakers and non-native speakers very often have some intuitions, but they certainly may not be accurate, and what they certainly cannot do is they cannot say that damage and problems and harm are the three most likely occurrences in British English. You said accident, right? Where is the accident? Okay, in 49th place. Yeah. So, I mean, that's not because your intuition is bad, but that's a word that maybe you had an accident a week ago and that's at the forefront of your mind. But that's still different from saying something about a whole population which is represented in this corpus. Now, corpus linguistics gives us sort of a window into not just one person's mind, but into, well, not the minds, but into the language that is produced by a very large cross-section of the speakers. And a lot of what you're working with now, dictionaries, and even some language learning material, is based on information that is retrieved from corpora. Those of you who work with a co-built corpus or Collins, it's all corpus-based. And we at the department tend to do a lot of research with these kind of resources because we feel that this is a more accurate or a more helpful way of doing linguistics than sitting back in an armchair and thinking about, can I say this? Yeah, that's interesting. Let's write a book about it. Okay. Now, of course, that's not how many how most linguists would work. This is more of a parody, but we still believe that this is a very reliable and helpful way of looking at language. So, if I've whetted your appetite, to whet someone's appetite, of course, is a collocation that you should be able to find in the corpus. Then maybe you want to look at the lecture, to listen to the lecture. If you want to access the corpus, then you can go to this address and you can sign up by clicking register for an account. This address, by the way, is slightly different than the one that is in the lecture because the address that's in the lecture doesn't exist anymore. If you use your University of Trier account, email account to register, you will get full access to the corpus. If you don't, then you will only get restricted access. And once you've done this, you can access the British National Corpus and this tool via this tool. And I'd just like to invite you to try it out and see whether you can find out something interesting about the language by looking at lots of it. Okay, that's the end of the semester. It's the beginning of the time when you will prepare for the exam, I guess. I'm not going to see you at the exam. I'm going to be in Finland while you are working away on the exam. I will be available for questions, probably via Skype. Not for you, sorry, but for the people who are invigilating the exam, just in case there is something that is going wrong, then they can contact me and can say, yeah, is this how the question is being meant or something like that. But you won't see me at the actual exam, and I wish you all the best for the exam. Good luck, and see you sometime in the future.